It's a pleasure to welcome everyone in this room to the 6th annual Hanno Mott Lecture on Jewish and Western Ethics here at the Jewish Center. Over these past now 6 years, we've engaged some of the most pressing issues of our moment and examined them through the lens of these multiple prisms. How do we determine when life comes to an end? In light of breakneck scientific advancement, what is the future of the Jewish family? What's the role of Torah values in a liberal democracy? Can the values of privacy and security peacefully and coherently coexist? And how do we apply the rabbinic mandate to accord authority to legal systems that are not our own? We've titled tonight's program, Like Dreamers, and in the parsha we'll read this week, the Torah repeatedly references the dream of all people. Yeshavtem al ha'aretz lavetach, to dwell securely in a land of their own. It has been and remains one of the great hopes of the Jewish people. But in the very same chapter, almost in the next breath, the Torah also tells us, v'chi yamuch achicha u'mata yado imach, v'chazak tabo ger v'sushav v'cha imach. If your neighbor, Jew or Gentile, falters, your solemn obligation is to lift him up so that he can survive and live alongside you. And of course, in a perfect world, we could apply these values in the same moment. We could have security on the one hand and a spirit of generosity on the other. But what happens when these values come into conflict? What happens when our impulse to give aid to the stranger and asylum to the refugee is threatened by the pall of violence or even terror? Sometimes we can reconcile the tension, and sometimes we cannot. But thinking about and talking about what happens when opposing values collide is always enriching. Part of our ongoing mission here at the Jewish Center is to grapple openly with the issues that matter most, both locally and globally. We take great pride in our continuing pursuit of excellence, and so it is with a deep sense of appreciation. But I want to thank Mr. Hanno Mott not only for sponsoring tonight's conversation, but for bringing to our center his passion for intellectual inquiry. We freely confess that we may not have all the answers, but we see it as part of our institutional mission to facilitate events like this one where we can grapple with the difficult questions. Hanno, thank you for making all of this possible. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the Jewish Center our former assistant rabbi, Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Samuels. Many of the people in this room remember Rabbi Samuels from his time here. Since leaving us, Rabbi Samuels has served as the rabbi of Congregation Shari Tzvila in Newton, Massachusetts for the past 24 years. 22 years, I stand corrected. He is the president of the Vat HaRabbanim of Massachusetts and a member of its Beit Din. He is a master teacher at Mayan, Torah Initiatives for Jewish Women, a Genesis scholar at Combined Jewish Philanthropies, and a member of CJP's Board of Governors. Rabbi Samuels earned a bachelor's in English Literature at Yeshiva College, is a Wexner Graduate Fellow, earned a master's degrees in both Bible and Medieval Jewish History from the Bernard Revel Graduate School at Yeshiva University, rabbinical ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, and most recently, just 6 months ago, he completed his doctoral dissertation at Boston University on the topic, How Advances in Science Change Jewish Law and Ethics, Assisted Reproductive Technologies, and the Redefinition of Parenthood. So we wish a mazel tov to Rabbi Samuels on that. It's a pleasure to introduce our second speaker, who I think is visiting the Jewish Center for the first time. After a career spanning more than 27 years, Mr. Stephen Pomerantz retired from the FBI in June 1995. I guess if you're going to leave the FBI, that's a preferable way to do it. As a general rule, I think it's preferred. During those 27 years, Mr. Pomerantz rose from a field investigative special agent to the rank of assistant director, the third highest position in the FBI. Mr. Pomerantz has represented the FBI and the law enforcement community on numerous occasions in a variety of settings, both domestically and internationally. Maybe you recognize him from his many appearances on evening television. He's an expert in the area of terrorism as well as criminal justice information. In January of 2005, he joined JINSA as Director of Counterterrorism Programs. I want to thank Simcha Lyons and our partners at JINSA for helping us connect to our speaker this evening. It's wonderful, as a general matter, to partner with JINSA, and we're blessed to have Mr. Pomerantz join us this evening from Washington, D.C. I'm going to ask Mr. Pomerantz... I'm going to ask Mr. Pomerantz to kick off our program. After his remarks, I'm going to ask Rabbi Samuels to present his remarks, and then we're going to open the floor to some conversation with the audience, and then we'll conclude with some final thoughts from our speakers. It's my pleasure to turn the program now over to Mr. Stephen Pomerantz.
Thank you, Rabbi. I think this will work if I don't have it in my hands. Okay. Please let me know if you can't hear me, and I'll alter my approach here. Thank you, Rabbi, for that. I haven't had a recent introduction like that. So, since you went down that road, Rabbi, I think paybacks are always appropriate. So, I don't know if you shared this with the rest of the congregation, but the rabbi was telling me just a couple of weeks ago, I won't use any names, I don't know if the person's here, but I don't want to embarrass them. One of the members of the congregation came to the rabbi and said, Rabbi, you just have to, I have to ask you to do something for me. This gentleman's been a member many, many years, a wonderful human being, wonderful husband and father. He said, you have to make me a Kohen. And the rabbi said, I can't do that. There's just nothing, it's not possible. It's not that I don't want to help you. It's not possible. The gentleman left, came back. A couple of weeks, you've heard this. The gentleman came back. A couple of weeks, says, but Rabbi, you just don't know how important this is to me. For my whole life, this is, you've just got to do this for me. Make me a Kohen. Rabbi says, listen, I've tried to, it's not that I'm unwilling, I cannot do that, it's not possible. Well, this gentleman leaves, comes back a third time, and makes the same plea and gets the same response. But this time the rabbi says, well, I don't understand. You're a wonderful human being, a wonderful man, a distinguished member of our congregation. You have a wonderful, why are you obsessing like this? And the man said to him, it's just a question of the honor of my family. My father was a Kohen. My grandfather was a Kohen. Okay. I had to get that out of my system. So I think you said 15 minutes, did you not? And I really want, if I can do it in 10, I'll do it in 10, because I have long experience doing this, which the thing I've learned most is much more comes out of a dialogue than a monologue. So it's not that I'm afraid to bore you, it's that I want to keep as much time as I can. In fact, Rabbi mentioned my TV appearances, which I started doing a great deal of, especially after 9/11. And at that time, my oldest daughter she must have been about 12 when I started doing that. And she got to where she'd come to the studio with me a lot. And they got to know her in the green rooms, and some of them in the makeup rooms, they put a little makeup on her, and she'd come very often. And one particular time, I was in a very difficult, in fact, it was a debate, not almost, but with myself and Alan Dershowitz taking different, and that's an intimidating, let me assure you, for a career FBI agent, that's a very intimidating moment. But I thought I did pretty well, and as I left the studio and walked back to the green room where my daughter was, I said, how did I do, sweetheart? How did I do? And she, this is honest, honestly true. She looked at me, never ask a child a question you don't want an honest answer to, right? And she said, Dad, you look good. You were really pretty boring, but you look good. So I hope tonight I will, in a short period of time, won't bore you. So when the rabbi called me and asked me to, invited me to come and do this, and through Simcha's intervention, I do less of this now than I used to do, but when I heard the subject, I don't think it took me 5 seconds to agree to this, because I think this is such an important issue. And even more than that, one that has really touched me very personally, and I hope to explain that as we go along here. So it was, it's a very important question, and I think given with my understanding of the dynamics of this whole series, it really, I can't think of anything that would be more, another subject as susceptible to this kind of approach and this kind of a dialogue than the subject of immigration. It really brings together, when you speak of immigration, it's the convergence of national security issues, law enforcement and criminal justice issues, morality, ethics, the essence of our, of the meaning of our country. All of that is, again, comes together probably more than any other issue when we try to sort through the issues associated with immigration. And I know that during my career, and believe me, I think this is typical of the FBI, contrary to what you often hear, see on television and read the newspapers. But certainly at the executive levels where we decide policy and make the most critical judgments, we really try to, A, uphold the law, certainly uphold the Constitution. I don't know if there's any other country in the world. My oath is not to a person, not to a political party, not to the flag, it's to a piece of paper. It's to the Constitution. I swore to uphold the principles of the Constitution against all enemies, domestic and foreign. And I meant it when I said it. And in my experience, the vast majority of certainly the executives I worked for who made decisions followed that. I learned my love of country from my grandfather. All of my grandparents, like I'm sure many of you in this room, were immigrants. My maternal grandparents had died before I was born, but I certainly had a very close relationship through my teenage years with my paternal grandfather, who came from, I'm sure, the same place, from Poland, as I'm sure many of you here. He taught me to love my country, and he taught me to love democracy. He taught me to love the democratic process. The greatest admonition I remember, I was born in 1942, and we all remember the early 50s and some of the issues that were alive then. My grandfather always told me when I was 8 or 9 years old, don't trust the communists. As if I was going to run into one on the way to school. But I remember that. I just do. And I never did trust the communists. But there's a lot of other people I learned not to trust. A lot of other people on all sides of the political spectrum. In the FBI, we really did not specifically deal with issues of immigration policy. That was not part of our portfolio. But we dealt intimately with the outcome of whatever the immigration policy was. We dealt with crime, when we dealt with counterintelligence, and increasingly, as time went by, when we dealt with counterterrorism. And part of my later responsibilities in the FBI was as chief of the FBI's counterterrorism, both internationally and domestically. So the issues and how decisions were made in the government about immigration impacted on our daily operations. I'll explain that a little bit. But I think it's important to take a look. I think we need to speak truth. Always speak truth. And today, in many areas of our lives, that's the ideology overcomes truth, and it clouds all of our discussions about all of these things are clouded by ideology. Particularly, that's particularly true in government, where as high as the Supreme Court of the United States. If I give you the outlines of an issue that has reached the Supreme Court, in many instances, you will know immediately how Justice Ginsburg is going to vote. I can just give you a set of facts that involve civil liberties in particular, and you will pretty much be able to predict how Justice Ginsburg is going to write her decision. You'll also be able to know how Justice Thomas is going to write his decision. So we all understand that ideology, political ideology, plays a very significant role in the way we approach all of these issues. from the perspective of the FBI, the perspective of the criminal justice and law enforcement system, we can't do that. We in the FBI learned our lesson, quite frankly, from J. Edgar Hoover. And we saw what happens when our motivation becomes ideological and the consequences it can have for America and American citizens, including our immigrants. And I think we learned our lesson well. I reference to my friend and former colleague, Jim Comey, who recently, as you know, was fired as director of the FBI. But Jim had on his desk a framed letter that the FBI had written to Martin Luther King during the days of the COINTELPRO, threatening letter to expose him, to expose some of his activities to the public. And he kept that on his desk as a reminder. This is the current director of the FBI, we've come a long way. And we do our best work when we simply stick to what the facts are and what the evidence and reality shows us. If you look at the history of immigration and tie it to the issue of civil liberties in our country, it is a much more complex and difficult scenario than what you learned in high school. This country has almost never been a universally welcoming place for immigrants, who, regardless of what it may say on the basis of the Statue of Liberty, regardless of Emma Lazarus's words, that has not been the history of the United States. Almost from the beginning, there were debates about who and how many people we should let into the United States. Associated with those debates, depending on the time, there were actions taken by the government that parallel the immigration process with civil liberties. It started in the Adams administration with the passing of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which was a response to what was going on with our conflict, but potential war, very close to war with France. So from the second administration, issues of immigration and civil liberties came into force. And that continued throughout the history of the country, particularly in times of crisis, which will, when we see ourselves nationally in a time of crisis, that's when we get tested most severely, both in terms of immigration and in terms of civil liberties. If you fast forward from the Alien Sedition Act, for example, to the Civil War period of time, not so much an issue of immigration, but certainly a crisis and an issue surrounding civil liberties. We saw the suspension of habeas corpus under the presidency of Abraham Lincoln, who we all regard, certainly I do, as maybe the greatest president of our time. But not to forget that Abraham Lincoln ordered the suspension of habeas corpus, the very basis of our criminal justice system, the right that everybody has to when they're charged and arrested, to appear before a judge. That was suspended during the Civil War, as were many of the First Amendment rights of free speech, and especially freedom of the press. World War I, again, immigration and civil liberties, the people of German descent in this country, where we fought World War I, were the subject of harsh policies, curtailment of their civil liberties, and immigration restrictions. Of course, that, at that point in time, with Germany, there was clearly no immigration. World War II offers us the clearest example. The clearest example, and you all know what that is. The rounding up of Japanese Americans who were not immigrants. Most of them, but not all, were born in this country. And they were rounded up with no regard for their rights or their immigration status, and locked up for the duration of the war in prison camps. You know, interestingly enough, with all of Mr. Hoover's faults, he was one of the few high officials who was opposed to that. He was opposed on the basis of a civil liberties issue. He said this was more like what Soviet government did than what the American government did. Post 9/11, fast forward to post 9/11, which is the era we're really living in now. Much of what we're seeing now in both the area of civil liberties and immigration stem from the events of 9/11. And history will have to judge whether we committed excesses in one or both, whether it's curtailment of civil liberties or the or immigration as a result of 9/11. But certainly that's everything we're doing now in both arenas, or most of what we're doing now in both immigration and civil liberties, is a direct result of what happened on 9/11. Let's talk, get more, let me take it down a level or two and talk about immigration specifically. Is there anybody in the room, and I'm not trying to embarrass anybody, I'm just trying to set the dimensions of the discussion, who believes that we should allow absolute free entry to our country? Open up, take the borders away, essentially. Anybody who wants to come in without regard to vetting, without regard to country of origin, without regard to anything. We should just allow, we should allow literally what is written on the basis of the Statue of Liberty. Does anybody believe that? Okay. I wasn't trying to embarrass you. There are people who believe that. But once you say you don't, I think you're setting the gateway as much as the boundaries of the argument. If you don't believe that, then you have to make two decisions. How many people that you let in? How many people? If you don't believe everybody should come, you've got to set a number, whether it's 12 or 12 million. That's the first problem, setting a number. And the second is who and what criteria do we use to identify those people that we're going to let in? And three, and I guess it's maybe 2A, how much do we vet those people? How much do we know about them as individuals, if anything, before we decide that we're going to let them into the country? There are consequences of those decisions and consequences to whatever we do in terms of immigration. We've answered the question of how many in different ways over our history. And I think probably, again, most of you, if you've been told anything, again, because of our Jewish backgrounds, about this, you've been told about the Immigration Act of 1924, which was, I think it's an exaggeration to say specifically designed to keep Jews out. It had more to do with, as much to do with Southern Europeans as it had to do with Jews, but it certainly had that effect. It certainly, Jews were knowingly part of what the law was passed to limit entry into the country, with obviously for us with very disastrous consequences. In recent years, the policy has been really directed by the idea of family unification. That if somebody comes in, we allow them to bring members of their family, so we keep families together. That is driven to a great extent, except for the specialized areas, specialized educational areas, and also, of course, the whole issue, which is very significant today, of asylum. We let people in who are in danger. Now, we talk about asylum, and again, there are a couple of sides to the argument. Does it mean that when you request asylum to come to the country, that means you as a specific individual, you know, Joe Smith, have to prove that you are in danger in your home country and therefore should be allowed into the United States? Does it mean that you as a member of a very identifiable and specific group, such as Jews in pre-war Europe, after the Nazis came to power, people who were on, as the people who were on the boat to St. Louis, as a group, but they were under threat, is that what it means? Or does it mean the entire population of Honduras, because it's by nature, the country is a dangerous place to live. There's no question about it. Honduras is a dangerous place to live. For any Honduran, pretty much. Does that mean that every person who shows up at the border and says, I'm from Honduras, should be granted a chance at asylum. There's no right answer and no wrong answer. It's going to depend on both the courts, and I think more importantly, it's a political decision we have to make. Excuse me. I want to talk for a minute about, I'm trying to bring this to get more down to base level with each additional point. I want to talk for a minute about the impact of immigration on law enforcement. And there is an impact. It is, once again, unrealistic, untrue, to claim, as some people do, that there is no impact on our communities, no negative impact on our communities, because of immigration. Most of our major cities in the United States, including this one, particularly for reasons that I'm not all that familiar with, but I know to be true, on Long Island, in Suffolk County, the threat posed by MS-13, the Central American gang, is substantial. There's substantial violence, horrible violence committed by that gang. In where I live, in suburban Washington, D.C., is another place where MS-13 is a terrible presence. I had lunch last week with the chief of police in Montgomery County, Maryland, which happens to be where the vast majority of the Jewish community lives, in Rockville and Bethesda and Potomac, Maryland. I asked what his biggest problem was. He didn't flinch. He said, MS-13. Biggest problem. MS-13 is entirely, the presence of MS-13 in this country is entirely a product of illegal immigration. They recruit their members in Central America with the knowledge of it, select them because of their ability to come to the United States, to successfully get into the United States, legally and illegally. MS-13 is a problem. It's not the only criminal problem that's resulted over the years from immigration. Each ethnic group that has immigrated to this country has brought with them, among other things, crime and organized crime, organized gang violence. The most famous, excuse me, I'm still recovering from a bout of pneumonia. This is the last thing to go away. Is La Cosa Nostra. Everybody knows that. We all know that. We've all seen The Godfather, et cetera. Seen the movies. That is a result. The presence of La Cosa Nostra in the United States is 100% the result of immigration. In that instance, mostly legal immigration. But believe it or not, this will win you a trivia bet. It actually started in New Orleans. They came, for whatever reason, they established themselves in New Orleans. It grew and expanded. There have been Jewish ethnic gangs. Anybody in the room as old as I am may remember the famous Purple Gang in Detroit, or Meyer Lansky and his people here in New York. They came as Jewish immigrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Does that mean that we should look back and say, shouldn't let the Italians in? I don't think so. But to deny that criminal problems do not result from immigration would be to deny the fact. That's why I got 2 minutes by my watch. So I saved the most significant one for the end. Middle East terrorism. Terrorism today, when I used to speak about terrorism, and I did speak, I was an American Jewish Committee speaker. From the time I retired, I go around to their chapters, and that was before 9/11. And speak about terrorism. I used to tell Jewish audiences, why should I talk to you about terrorism? Why should you be any more concerned about terrorism than the people down the road at the Catholic Church? And there's a reason. Because the terrorism of the late 90s and into this century is primarily that emanates from the Middle East. Primarily. That's where dangerous terrorism today emanates from. And as a Jew, I used to say, if you go into shark-infested waters and the shark bites you, your chances of being bitten are not in any way tied to your ethnicity, your age, your gender. It's if it's your turn to get bitten by the shark, you're going to get bitten if he's there. It's not true with terrorism. The number of Jewish targets selected by Middle East terrorist groups is disproportionately Jewish. We are their enemies. It's that simple. It really is that simple. So the immigration of people from that part of the world to this country poses a legitimate threat. There is no denying that. How much of a threat? That's another issue. Is the threat commensurate with limiting or excluding those immigrants? That's a political question. You're free to answer any way you want. But to deny that it's true would be a denial of the facts. Anybody who needs to know, who wants to know that, go to Europe. Go to Europe, go to England, go to France, go to Belgium, and see what the Jewish communities feel and how they're reacting to the influx of people from those countries to their country. It's a problem. And how we deal with that will have a real impact for all of us as Americans. I want to conclude with a thought, a personal thought, which is what I started with. When I was in the Bureau dealing with these issues, and I did deal with them, and I believe I made fair decisions. But I, in order to do that, I had to separate myself. I had to separate myself into Steve Pomerantz, the FBI executive, chief of counterterrorism, Steve Pomerantz, just the American citizen, and Steve Pomerantz, the Jew. And how I answer goes, the decisions I made depended on which hat I was wearing. As the chief of counterterrorism, I had to make decisions that were lawful, within the proper boundaries of the FBI scope of authority, and legal under the Constitution of the United States. People, even today, I have people come to me from the Jewish community, and they'll say, I had this last week. Last week, a woman, a very prominent member of the Los Angeles Jewish community, said to me, and I get this a lot, I get lots of criticism from the FBI from both sides. Why aren't you doing more in the mosques in America? Why aren't you monitoring, why don't you have agents in every mosque listening to what the imams say to determine what's going on in the mosques? I looked at her and I said, you don't want us to do that. You think we should put an FBI agent every Friday in a mosque in America? Yes. Well, I said, how would you feel if we put an FBI agent in every synagogue in America on Saturday to see what the rabbis were saying to Monday? And she thought for a minute, she said, that would be all right. That would be all right, too. If it's going to help protect, you got to do one to do the other. I said, ma'am, with all due respect, we don't live in the same country. Well, at least I don't live in the country that, I don't want to live in a country that you want to live in. But I have to tell you this. I have to conclude with this thought. As a Jew, I look at what's happening around the world, and I look what's happening in Europe, and I go to Israel, and I now see that I used to see myself limited by my inability to speak Hebrew. Now I see myself limited by inability in certain places to speak French. And who would have thought? You know, French Jews are leaving, and they're not leaving because of Marine Le Pen. They're leaving because of the Middle East population that's come to their country. I fought for this country in war. My cousin, Sammy Rosenzweig, died for this country in war. I love this country. I want my children and my grandchildren to grow up to be full-fledged American citizens. And it concerns me. I have to say, as a Jew, when I look at what's happening in those places around the world, I'm concerned. So I'm not so sure that I'm going to stand up tomorrow and join the movement to welcome thousands of Syrian immigrants to this country. I know what the Syrians are like. I've been there. I know what they're like. And they are, as a country, they are as anti-Semitic as people in Germany were in the day. This is a very complex issue. And all I would think is, you're here to listen to all of us, and each other, and I would just urge you as you go forward to be swayed by the facts, to be influenced by the facts, and not the ideology.
Good evening, everyone. I hope you'll forgive me if I begin with some personal words. This is a beautiful moment for me personally to participate in the centenary of the Jewish Center, where I spent my most formative professional years as assistant and disciple of Rabbi J.J. Schachter, my beloved mentor of rabbinics. Ari Berman was my chavrusa, Rabbi Berman, and he was the rabbinic intern when I became the assistant rabbi, and then became the assistant rabbi after that, and then rose to the ranks. And to be here with my dear friends, Rabbi Levine and Rabbi Zirkin. The Jewish Center looks as elegant as ever. In fact, in 1994, I remember when they refurbished this beautiful space. But the splendor of the Jewish Center has always been its rabbinic leadership, its lay leadership, and its members. And it still is the flagship of modern orthodoxy, standing for those sacred values that we hold dearly. And it's a great privilege and honor to be here with all of you, with dear friends from many years past, and perhaps with some new acquaintances. I also have to say I'm greatly humbled to share the podium with Stephen Pomerantz, whose exemplary record of service to our great country just is unparalleled. Thank you for your words and for your model. Rabbi Levin was kind enough to read my ostensible credentials before, but you would probably, if you were listening, you would notice none of them have anything to do with immigration or political policy. So to share the podium with someone who actually has spent a lifetime dealing with it is a very humbling experience, and I thank you for being a partner to this dialogue and this exploration. This topic of immigration is a deeply, deeply personal topic. Of course, it's a fascinating theoretic ethical conundrum, and it is an important political and public policy discussion that's layered with so many controversies, presidential privilege and congressional authority, and interlayered with partisan politics and things that have nothing to do with immigration per se. And it's also deeply personal because of its human dimensions. As Stephen said so eloquently before, probably all of us, if not most of us in the room, are first, second, or third generation Americans. We are all the children of immigrants. In fact, I had a dear friend and a congregant, the late Rabbi Richard Israel of blessed memory. And he told the following story. He said that once he got in a cab, it might have been Manhattan, but he didn't mention where. And before he could ask the driver, who often is an immigrant, where do you hail from? The driver turned the question to him and said, what are your origins? So there he is in the back seat of the cab, and he was just asked, what are my origins? So he said, I started to think. I was born in the United States. My parents were born in London. Before that, we believe we trace our heritage to the Spanish-Portuguese heritage, and that would have landed us in Spain. But before that, were we in Israel? Were we in Babylonia? At which, after 30 or 60 seconds passed, the cab driver said, you must be Jewish. He said, how do you know? He said, you're taking way too long. So, not only is this an immigrant experience for American Jews, our whole history, which has been
tarnished by exile, and also, to be fair, ennobled by exile, is a story of immigration, of wandering, and it's deeply personal. Now, I don't think that is necessarily a negative. We certainly have to be self-aware of our biases when we approach any issue. But the model of the Torah, both in the Torah Shebichtav, in the written Torah, the five books of Moses, as well as in the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, always has companions of statutory law and case law, the law on one side, and then the multidimensionality and messiness of human experience on the other hand. The Torah layers narrative and law together, as does the Talmud. And so we can't speak in the abstract without considering the human impacts, and we can't only be moved by human impact and human story, as empathetic as we aspire to be, without the consideration of the full scope and measure of the issue. And so what we do try to aspire when we take on such a challenging and important and fundamental issue such as immigration, we try to bring both our personal insight as human beings and our experience as Jews, as well as a more abstract analytical assessment of the issue. Now, there are, as far as I can tell, and Stephen referred to them before, and so I apologize if I'm repeating a tiny bit, there are three areas which relate to immigration. There's asylum and refugees, and that's temporary sanctuary. It may lead to permanent resettlement, but often the legal framework for refugees and asylum is a temporary sanctuary. And what are the criteria for asylum? It's usually political or religious persecution and oppression. But what about hunger? Should hunger, not having enough to eat, not having education, not having health care, should these be a criteria for asylum? They are not. They are not usually. It's usually a question of persecution. And then besides asylum and refugees, we have legal immigration policy, right? People who apply to legally immigrate to this country. And here we get into the questions that Stephen also raised about numbers. How many do we let in on a yearly basis? What are the qualifications for the people we're looking to join our society? And how do we vet them in a fair and reasonable and thorough fashion? And from what my reading has shown me is this is a thicket of issues to decide those questions. And then, of course, we also deal with illegal immigration, or sometimes called undocumented aliens. Do we deport them? Do we forgive and legalize them? And that also is a thicket. So when we speak about immigration, we're really speaking about a wide-scoped issue that has many different permutations. So as a rabbi and as an aspiring scholar who stands before you, what can I bring to this conversation? I ask myself to forge a Torah point of view on any ethical issue, but we're focusing on immigration. What is our method that we employ to arrive at a Jewish viewpoint and assessment of the issue of immigration? And I'd like to suggest that there are four steps to the methodology of forming a cogent and well thought out opinion. The first step, some of you who are attorneys in the crowd may recognize from law school, it's called issue spotting. Right? What are the issues involved in immigration? Immigration is a single word, but there are lots of sub-issues, many of which Stephen referred to before. The second is, we need an orientation. There's no such thing as just objective observations. Anytime we measure or observe something, we are filtering it through the lenses by which we view our world. And so we need some type of ethical orientation. What are our foundational values that help us frame how we view these issues? So in addition to spotting the issues and orienting our ethics, we also want to identify localized halachic discussions that can serve as either legal precedents or legal analogies.
In other words, there's a bit of a dialectic between meta-ethics and then deriving ethics from discrete contexts and legal precedents. So have Jews ever dealt with these issues before? And if they have, what have those localized Jewish legal halakhic discussions yielded? And finally, we come to an application. After we spotted all the issues, we establish our ethical orientation, we've surveyed the literature to see whether there's any precedents or analogies by which we can come up with good law and good policy, we need to form a concrete policy, make recommendations. And so that's my understanding of how we would arrive at a Torah point of view for the issue of immigration. So, let's do some issue spotting. Okay. The obligation to include versus the right to exclude. The obligation to include versus the right to exclude. Now, part of that question, which is one of the fundamental questions of immigration debate, is, first of all, and Steve, you hit it right on the nose, right, is there a moral legitimacy to national boundaries? Or should anyone be able to go anywhere they want? And when you read the philosophers of immigration, there are indeed philosophers who come from a point of view that that boundaries are artificial, national entities are artificial, and that people should be able to traverse those boundaries if for any number of reasons, either the fraternity of all human beings, that national identities are dissolve, or the redistribution of wealth through the sharing of natural resources. We happen to live in a country with great resources. We have efficient means of accessing them. We have great means of distributing them. Why not let everyone in to share that wealth? And people argue and debate the moral legitimacy of national boundaries. Stephen spoke to security issues, and that certainly is a major issue. Then there are economics. And it's not just a question of supply and demand. More people lowers working wages. It's not only an impact on employment, as important as that is, and economic growth and urban development, but there's so many layers to the question of economic impacts. Costs of education, healthcare, do we weaken or strengthen the safety net? Do we attenuate our ability to serve our own citizens? And will we do right by the people who then move to our country? How do we come up with a reasonable framework? The much more difficult issue that I have spotted is what is referred to as cultural or social cohesion. Right, this is the danger where immigration law becomes an admissions policy. Who are the people that we want? And it borders on giving sanction to bigotry. On the one hand, in our Jewish tradition, we're not that surprised by such an idea because in the Torah it speaks about resident aliens in the land of Israel who have to at least comport themselves with what we call the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the basic moral code, the Noahide code. And yet at the same time, in this great country, one of the reasons why we have been so successful as Jews is because part of the social compact is religious freedom, ethnic pluralism, whether you conceive of it as a melting pot or a salad bowl. During times of economic instability and social transformation, like we have been experiencing over the past number of years, the question of using immigration policy as an admissions policy and trying to maintain this is of course at great debate and responsible in part for the polarization we experience in our country. And so we want to consider all of these difficult issues, but what is the overall ethical orientation that we bring to these issues? Now, often, coming up with an ethical orientation to halakhic issues isn't necessarily easy. When it comes to immigration, it is relatively easy. And that's because, in our tradition, we have numerous
One rabbi in the Talmud says it's 24 instances in the Torah. Another rabbi says it's 48 instances in the Torah. These have numerous mandates, injunctions, prescriptions that we have to concern ourselves with the stranger, with the other, with the alien. Now that's not new to you. I brought on your source sheets. In source number 3, I pulled a list of such verses in English from an internet article, essential verses in the Torah regarding the stranger. I apologize, I see I made a typo. Regarding the stranger, you shall not wrong nor oppress a stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. And lest anyone say, but stranger there, the Hebrew word ger, doesn't that mean a convert to Judaism? So that's why I brought source number 1, the Sefer HaChinuch, who in his enumeration of the 613 commandments, in the commandment dedicated to Ahavat Hagir, loving the convert, taking that Hebrew word that appears numerous times in the Hebrew Bible as convert, he ends with an exhortation, which is that it doesn't just apply to Jews. The mitzvah in its atomistic application is about converts, but the ethical scope of this mandate, of this persistent exhortation in the Torah to be kind, not oppress, and to even love the stranger, applies to anyone who is not in the land of their birth or the place of their